You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Guidepost Podcast. You have Captain Cody Rubner here. I am with Tony Friedrich, two members of the ASGA team, and I could see a little glimmer in Tony's eye right now. He seems pretty happy, and I know he's a patriotic man and loves America, but I don't think it's just about the holiday. I think that grill is heating up, and he's got some plans to throw down.
Yeah, we gotta cut this short, man. I'm on a timetable. I'm putting a pork shoulder I got from the butcher yesterday.
Okay.
None of that cheap grocery store junk. And I'm going to be 8 hour smoke, 225, two super smoke on the Traeger, and cube it up. Put some delicious sauce and more seasoning on it. Put it in for an hour at 300, and you got burnt ends. And I am telling you, I'll be eating that for 2 days. I'll be eating it for breakfast, lunch. I'll probably make a salad out of it to make myself feel better at some point. But I'll be
any listeners who live within 9 hours of Tony's address. If you listen to this right now, you have 9 hours to start driving to get in on it.
Like 5 pounds of burnt ends here around somewhere around 5:30, 6 o'clock tonight. So.
That's sounding darn good. I'm down with the food game. I'm down with the patriotic holiday game. But I, out of being a young, growing, grumpy old guide, typically holiday weekends is when I like to hide. I go into my my shell. And
listen, where I live, you know, I complain about it all the time, man. The beach traffic. We basically figured out a day or two ago all the supplies that we needed until Monday. We have no intention besides taking our son here, there, and everywhere. We have no intention of leaving this house. We have no intention. That was a 2 minutes, 12 seconds. We have no intention of leaving this house for the next several days.
Oh, everyone, hunker down. Enjoy your holiday. Be safe. I just saw back where I grew up. I just saw that they had a malfunction where all the fireworks went off at the Mashpee Country Club on Cape Cod.
Nobody was hurt. I shouldn't laugh.
Multiple people were hurt, okay. So we'll cut that laugh out.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You want to know why? Because yesterday my Instagram feed was filled with people with two fingers, like the X-rays.
Yeah, it's a big thing.
And they're like, just think about this.
If we have any Giants, oh no, you're a Giants fan, yeah. Right? Didn't Jason Pierre-Paul, didn't he blow up his hand on fireworks?
Right after Plaxico Burress shot himself in the leg at a strip joint.
Good run for the Giants.
A solid couple of months there for the Giants.
Shout out to the New York Giants PR team from that year. I'm sure they were. Or I hope they got a good Christmas bonus. Yeah. Well, we got a couple things to chat about real quick. We'll give you another episode, some latest updates, what we're talking about, what we're up to. One kind of positive and then one that's a little bit more negative, but that's a very worthy discussion. And maybe we'll start on the quick positive, but many of y'all have watched or been a part of the fight that y'all have seen regarding redfish management in Louisiana over the last, let's say, 2.5 years or so. That's really picked up steam. And the short and sweet for those who know nothing about it or just want the high level. Regulations for redfish didn't change for almost 40 years in Louisiana, and a group of community of guides and anglers and shop owners and just everyday citizens who care about the resource down there united, and through a kind of laborious process, and didn't get perfectly what we're hoping for, but they got regulations changed and the protection of bull reds. And then you watch how this played out over the last year and a half ish since those regulations went into place and you start to see different changes being added on. In addition, the Biloxi Marsh, you just recently had the permanent banning of bow fishing and nighttime activities to try to protect those fish. So you kind of have this wave of conservation. Cody, can we
talk
to try
about
to
that. We've never talked about that on the podcast. Can you give me like 2 minutes to talk about it? So like, we know where our core membership is. You know, we know we started out as the striper guys and girls. Sorry, Sue. We started out as the striper group. And I want you all to picture this. So I want you to picture like a perfect scenario on a beach, surf fishing, or you know, you're on a flat and you see a school of stripers in front of you. And all of a sudden they spook from like 200 feet away, every school. And you're like, what the hell's going on? And then you walk a little bit down the beach and there's a dead sea robin. And then there's a dead, I don't know, houndfish or, you know, just dead stuff with holes in it. And you're like, the hell is going on? And then you look and there's prop scars all on the bottom. And then you kind of like, wow, these stripers are a little jittery. Well, it was because all night long there was a bunch of jagaloons in a boat with a million candle power lights hooked onto the bow with people on the bow with bows drawn shooting everything from 4 feet away because it's completely blinded from the lights. And then one day you're fishing and you see like a 40-inch striper swim by with an arrow in its head. That's what our guys were doing, putting up with every day in Louisiana. And the fact that you could take, without question, the most economically valuable fish to the state and then have a bunch of guys running around all night long. There's no enforcement. Louisiana doesn't have the funds to have nighttime enforcement. And then the other thing is during duck season, these ducks are laid up on their roost and these guys are disturbing them. And that is a federal crime.
Not to mention that it's also a slot for the redfish. So you have guys on the bow judging like, no, that one's perfect.
Yeah, you got to measure with your eyes. Actually, Cody, we could pull it up, but at a commission meeting not very long ago, when we were talking about not killing bull redfish, one of the bow fishing captains went up and said, well, my people are still going to want to shoot them. And I'm not going to tell them anything. And if they shoot them, it's their fault and it's not my fault. Bulls.
How thoughtful.
Oh my gosh. Conservation dripping from every pore of their body. So it was so bad. Just so y'all know, we're not kidding around. You know, there's marinas, private marinas down there that have ramps. And those are kind of like the central hub of the area. And just, you know, just like the big ramps in the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast. And the ramp owners were having to call LDWF to get rid of nuisance alligators that were eating the carcasses of all the dead fish. And if you want to just gag, just, you know, search up Louisiana bow fishing redfish and you'll probably pass out. I mean, they're killing 60, 70 year old alligator gar. There's no limit on sheep's head. I mean, just anything that swims, they shoot. So you know what? They can't do it anymore in the 50,000 acres of Biloxi Marsh. And that is a huge win for a lot of our people. And, you know, we're looking, no, here's the bottom line. We are looking to expand that. You cannot do one activity that negatively impacts seriously everyone else. The duck hunters, the guys who are using popping corks and dead shrimp, the guys who are using light tackle spinning, our fly guys, everyone. It hurts everyone. And then you just kind of get up there and you kind of have a brazen attitude like, screw you, I'll shoot whatever I want. Cody, did you see the commission meeting last time where there was a landowner? I'm not going to get into the land laws in Louisiana, but it's pretty complicated. They're actually under the Napoleonic Code, and it's based on a map from the early 1800s. We won't go there right now. But a landowner got up at a commission meeting and basically said, I've asked these guys to, you know, just respect my property, do this, this, and this. And he woke up the other morning and one of his cows was shot dead. So this is like not a game. And these guys have little or no concern for the resource or anyone else. And, we're not afraid to take a stand and say stuff, and we don't dance around things, but we are.
Well, that's where you talk about, you know, it takes courage to do this stuff. I mean, that's someone like that's hoping something, an action like that will just make you stop. And the reality is it takes courage from certain people to stand up, to make things stop, because if not you, then who, right? So
I just wanted to, yeah. As the conservation grows in Louisiana, it puts pressure on other Gulf states to do the same thing, because I mean, let's face it, like there's no place in the world like Louisiana. And my message to everyone that's listening is this: whether it's redfish in South Carolina or Georgia, whether it's stripers all up and down the coast, I don't know, whether it's menhaden, like if you can do it in Louisiana and Alabama, you can sure as hell do it here. Everyone, you know, loves to make fun of, you know, that culture down there. Well, guess what? They've taken more conservation strides in the last 2 or 3 years than I've seen in the Northeast in the last 10. With the exception of Mass DMF and the Albies and the Bonito in North Carolina with the Albies. Like, let's give credit where credit's due. I'm kind of lasering in on striped bass and then redfish in the South Atlantic. Like, the stereotypes are not true. These people culturally understand how important these fish are, and they will do the hard things when push comes to shove. So kudos to LDWF for lighting the candle. Kudos to Alabama for making the hard decision. And we just hope it keeps growing. So Cody, so we're pretty excited. You know, I was talking about bow fishing here and I kind of threw in Alabama. So Cody, tell them what happened in Alabama. And then I'm going to kind of touch on something else too. That's real close to home for you.
Yeah. I mean, you see a move from another neighboring state, in the Gulf, making the same or similar, not to say the same, but similar changes and, reducing bag limit. You're down to 3 fish per person per day. You see a slot limit of 16 to 26 in the major takeaway or the major focus is you see the no take on bull redfish. And so, momentum drives momentum, right? And energy sparks more energy. And I don't think, being the first, you might have a different take on this, Tony, but I have to venture to guess that being the first is always the most challenging when it comes to management, you leading the charge and breaking the mold. You know, a lot of these managers are all set in the way.
We went through in North Carolina, dude, for Albies. Right? I mean, we went through a hell of a lot in Massachusetts, too. There was a lot of work that went into that, but it does get easier for each one. But like, you know. Oh,
God. Well, it gives the first person gets the second person some defense because it gives them a model to look at. It gives them an example to lean upon when trying to garner more momentum and support in their state. And so you see a state like Louisiana that hasn't made redfish changes in decades, and all of a sudden they make these changes, and it probably sparks a little bit of self-reflection in neighboring states. And so so shortly after, and with a lot of the redfish stuff in Louisiana still very much in the news and major headlines, and you look at the freezes that happened over the winter and all these different things going on, it's just awesome to see another state make a science-driven change. It shows how critical that first step is. You know, for people who work out a lot and, go to the gym, going to the gym is easy. You know, hey, you work out a decent amount. Yeah, you want to go to the gym, get a lift in right now? That's nothing for someone. For someone who hasn't been to the gym in 5 years, that first time stepping into the gym is the hardest part. And I think, I don't know if I ever brought this up on podcast before, but like there are people that say, if you're struggling to get in the gym for the first time in years, You should literally just drive to the gym and park in the parking lot and then go home. Because at least it's progress. At least it's momentum. At least you went the distance and got yourself there. And the next time, maybe you walk in that front door. And so overall, just a really good example. And people should, even if you have never seen a redfish in your life and don't care about them at all in the slightest, you should be looking at this as, you know, hey, so maybe that means if this state made this change with something I really care about, Tog, you know, to Tog up north, or Jack Crevalle in South Carolina. Hey, maybe if South Carolina made some moves on Jack Crevalle due to this, this, and this, maybe Georgia and Florida would be next. It kind of sparks those conversations, and it doesn't really matter what fishery you're putting it within the lens. Momentum drives more momentum. So pretty exciting news out of Alabama. And it gets me excited to look back at other fisheries and try to spark more momentum.
I was talking to one of our science friends, and I had read this before. This is kind of amazing. So FWC and BTT worked together and found kind of a one of a kind area that is the, not a, the spawning aggregation for bonefish for Biscayne Bay in Florida. And they are considering a rule now to close, bonefish have a very long spawning period. It's not like they're there the whole time. They'll get on the site, pull off, come back, pull off, you know, like, it, but this is a tiny area. It's 1.74 square miles in the ocean off Biscayne Bay. And it is a one of a kind spawning aggregation for bonefish. And based upon the science from our friend at BTT and FWC, they're proposing a closure for that tiny area. How could you not support that? It's in deep water. People are not fishing for these things unless, you know, I think the greatest fear in the world is it turns into like somebody finds it and they're like, hey, let's go catch a 10-pound bonefish on a shrimp and a J hook. And it's like, oh God, like on a, like, you know, with like a school that just, you know, reads false bottom on your sonar. Like, that's a good thing that's happening in Florida. We could talk about a lot of bad thing that's happening in Florida, but that is like science in action. Here they are. We found them. This is where they do the deed. They supply all the bonefish for Biscayne Bay. That's like a gazillion-dollar industry. Let's do the smart thing and protect them before there's a problem. That's another thing just to keep an eye out for everyone, because that's going to be heating up. We'll end up commenting on it.
Why don't we go into the, you know, the spawning protection stuff there? Because as a theory, right, you have your small fish, you have your big fish. Your big fish make more of your small fish, and that's what keeps your fishery going. And a healthy fishery, generally speaking, has, you know, a nice spread of size classes. More smaller fish, the way it works, more smaller fish, and then the total numbers of fish is going to lean out theoretically as you get closer to the bigger classes. But I have never understood the propensity to really hammer on, and even this, it brings me back to all the way back to when I used to fish in the competitive bass series and travel around the freshwater bass series. And I had a jersey covered in logos 10 years ago. We bounce around, but when they have tournaments that fish the spawning fish, the bedded fish, and I've never understood the propensity to target those fish. You know, they're obviously the bigger fish. They're concentrated from an angler's perspective. They're massive fish. They're concentrated. It's your easiest path to getting a big fish. But for managers to allow and not recognize, okay, if we, regardless of this fishery's largely release, if it's largely harvest, if we know where this action occurs that creates the next generation of fish that keeps this natural resource going. I have never understood why that is not one of the critical focuses for management. And so it's different. It doesn't work for every species. Some of them spawn in the Gulf Stream. Some of them spawn X, Y, and Z 500 feet deep on whatever. But for inshore and nearshore fisheries that is concentrated and documented, you're talking about this one spot for bonefish. I've gone on personal public record regarding snook in my area on the Treasure Coast of Florida of there's only so many inlets. And there are spawning section, there are spawning activities that have been documented in the past in slightly different areas adjacent to these. But it's also, when it comes to enforcement and a regulation, depending on where the spawning aggregation is, it meets a lot of the requirements for enforcement. And so if I just said, hey, no more fishing with red topwater plugs tomorrow, that's the reason all the striped bass are dead. How do you enforce it? No one's got red topwater plugs, right? You can't enforce that stuff. But if I tell you all of the female snook are piling into this jetty and that is where they spawn for these 3 months, to say, hey, no fishing at that jetty.
Yeah, and then you see somebody like clunking them in the head with live bait and then taking the picture of a giant snook and you're like, dude.
One person to see five boats all buy their bait and sprint there every morning. Every single morning to be the first person to get some to, you know, what, why, you know, why people fish croakers, right? Is because croakers eat the eggs of redfish and snook. So you're basically like, hey, my fishing strategy today, let's agitate spawning fish in a way that we know, maximizing the reaction. Yes. And so you look at this bonefish thing, you look at, you know, the protections I'd love to see around key snook stuff. And then I know you're about to jump in with stripers here. It's just it's a concept that is just not as foreign as people make it out to be. And I don't know why it's not leaned into more.
Cody, I don't know how long. So there's a huge misconception, an enormous misconception with Maryland. And look, I think it's been pretty clear since day one that we are not. We don't really pull any punches with Maryland when it comes to striped bass, right? So look, Maryland's got this thing where they're like, let's open up April to catch and release again. I haven't seen the final numbers. We're kind of agnostic on it. Okay. Like the way that I feel is big picture is like, I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. Right now, it's a little tone deaf. Like if you're paying staff members to work on this, maybe those resources could be better served because we're in a lot of trouble. But I'm not going to go down that road right now. But this is what people, I'm looking at the comments and I don't think this is what people realize. If you go, and this builds on the bonefish thing that Cody and I were talking about, the snook thing. If you go to Maryland, just type in Maryland DNR season closures and you'll see these maps. And of course, the way they laid it out is super confusing. You need like an abacus and a user guide to figure out the maps. But it starts on March 1. Okay. And on March 1, go all the way through all the ridiculous maps. It looks like a Benetton ad. For those people who are Gen Xers, it's just colors everywhere. It goes from March 1 to June 1. And any spawning river, any river in the bay that has a decent amount of spawning activity is closed from the mouth of the river to the start of the river from March 1. In Maryland jurisdictional waters from March 1 to June 1. So what Maryland DNR is calling for essentially is to open up the main stem of the bay for catch and release. Once those fish go to stage in the river mouth, you are not allowed to fish in those rivers and you will get into a lot of trouble. I know people who were legitimately fishing for white perch that were staging to spawn and got, you know, banned from fishing in Maryland for 6 months. I mean, it was not, it was not a joke. Like, they got into a lot of trouble. But here's it, Cody, here's the other thing. So if you get caught fishing in them rivers between, so they look at the, here's perspective, common person perspective. I'm moving to the Chesapeake Bay to retire. I find a lovely house on the Choptank River. I'm envisioning myself fishing constantly. And then I buy the home, buy a boat, look at the regulation book, and find out I can't fish in that damn river until June 1st. I've always wondered that, you know, like how pissed off people were when they figured that out, that you have to go out into the, you know, the main stem of the bay. So again, look, I'm not trying to sell this, but what I'm trying to say is, like, just look at the maps, because what Cody's saying about protecting, you know, where they spawn, these are not little rivers. You know, they're going 20, 30, they're traveling a lot of miles from the mouth of that river to where actually the spawning occurs, which is, you know, around zero salinity. That's kind of like where that spawning will hit, you know? So it's already closed. They're not talking about opening it. That they'll never open those rivers. You know, and that's all I wanted to say is, like, you look at the bonefish thing, you look at the snook thing that's Cody's talking about, and we have had those protections in for striped bass for decades. And I got to tell you, like, the fishermen back when we could fish in April, back when there was a catch and release season, you'd see when you were fishing, you'd see a boat that, you know, like, zip into the river. And, you know, they were cheating and just risking it for a big fish, risk getting caught. And I got to tell you, those people were not respected amongst, like, the fishing community. You know, you'd see them, you know what they were doing. They had little code words. They'd say, I think it was back in the day that they were fishing in Chris Field. And, you know, we'd call and report them. So, that is not what's opening. Please don't think I'm trying to sell in everyone or we're going to support the Maryland thing. That's not why we're talking about it. I told you we're agnostic on it. I look at it, I kind of think it's tone deaf. We are in deep trouble in the bay. I mean, I'm not going to get into it. It is, there is not a fishery right now for striped bass. Period. End of sentence. And I think if you fish here, you kind of see that proposal from Maryland. And this here's the deal, right? They stopped us from fishing in April. They started that a couple of years ago. And it was basically just to rob Peter to pay Paul. They wanted the charter guys to keep killing two fish. They wanted, you know, and they just said, well, you can't do this. We'll gin up some numbers. Look like we're saving something. And then the fish that we save by y'all not being able to catch and release in cold water when everything's safe, those fish, we'll give them to these guys later in the year and they can kill them. That was it. And it really crushed a lot of businesses around here. A lot of people went out of business, a lot of guides, a lot of tackle shops. And I think DNR is looking at it now and they kind of realize the error of their ways. But it's kind of too little too late. You know, it's just too little too late. I would love to be able to fish for anything during April in the first 2 weeks of May. But because of what I do for a living, I can't even walk next to tidal waters because I can't risk that conversation. And that sucks. So if you think about it, you know, we can't fish 45 days in the spring. We can't fish another chunk of time in the summer. And it's just destroying the fishing economy around here. And on top of that, there's no fish. So anyway, those protections are not going away. And sounds like they need them for snook and other species and bonefish. And no matter what happens with this meeting coming up, those areas are not going to be open. So, Cody, since we're talking about spawning so much, boy, did we get a lot of fun comments when we were trying to educate people on the most recent science on striped bass. So we really covered two things.
Can I read my favorite one?
Yes, but let me say the topics and then just read some of the funny ones. So the first topic was, and I find this fascinating, and I've been screaming about this for years, is that stripers don't get a ring on their scale for every year they're alive. So if you look at all the old striper charts, which are all over the internet, it says a 15-year-old fish is 50 inches long. We all knew that was not true. So then they started doing these otolith studies. And the otolith is the inner ear bone. They can slice it in just a certain way. And that is like incredibly accurate. And what we were finding is, you know, much like redfish, once stripers hit a certain size, they start growing real slow. Real slow. And we obviously know the biggest fish are females. And the reason, you know, biologically, once a fish gets a certain size, so like a redfish, when it's a juvenile, it can put on like an inch a month. So like if you catch a 16-inch fish in May, that fish could very easily be over 20 inches by September, October. They grow like gangbusters. You could watch them grow with stop, you know, that with that photography, like time lapse photography. Stripers don't grow that fast, but both species, when they hit a certain length, that all of that food, all that energy, it kind of starts going into egg production instead of growth. So, I mean, a 40-something inch striper could be well over 30 years old. So that was one thing. And the second thing is we cited studies going back to the early 2000s that the biggest females produced astronomically more eggs, and each individual egg is larger because it has more yolk. So anyone would understand that that is an evolutionary advance. And they're also the first ones to spawn in, like, you know, very early in the season. So how is that not an evolutionary advantage? Do you think that all the eggs are bad in the big fish and they're the first to spawn and they produce the most and they're the biggest with the most yolk, and those larvae, by the time, like, you know, July comes around, those first stripers that spawned are way bigger than the last stripers that spawned the young of the year? So no, that wouldn't give the fish an advantage. No. They're all the eggs are bad. Stripers get menopause and we're dumb for following science. So Cody, please, as our communications director, please rattle off some of the more insightful comments that we got on social media when we were delivering science to try to elevate people.
I like the one that just got straight to the point, right? Like, let's trim the fat. I'd like to see the last one caught dead along with Red Drum. Okay. So let's just delete two of the most critical inshore fisheries on the East Coast. I believe that person added some nuance to their already so incredibly thoughtful argument, which was essentially that they believe they are eating all of the crabs and that we're going to run out of crabs because of striped bass and redfish, that they cannot coexist. But the, you know, jokes aside, the tough part or what we try to do is there are varying opinions on a bunch of stuff. And the reality is, though, we need to try to have some sort or form of honest conversation. So when things are thrown in from people, you can tell who is just trying to get to their end point. We all have biases in life. We all have biases in an argument and a stance of what we think. But You can tell who's trying to have an honest conversation and who is just trying to look for the shortest possible path to kill all conversation to get to their end point. And so you see things thrown in like, the majority of fish released turn into crab food anyways. It's not the majority. I mean, we have science that's older and has been replaced by new science, and it found almost the exact same thing. So you're talking about 9%, and that's across all different types of method of catch for wreck. So again, like why
Cody,
can't we
Cody,
have-
we caught a much more delicate fish, false albacore. We pulled them out of the water, shoved their heads into a homemade tuna tube, cut them open, shoved a piece of electronic equipment up them, sewed them up, and threw them back in. And our paper on release mortality for albies is coming out. And it was surprisingly good. And I'm not going to talk about it because it hasn't. I just have a draft manuscript right now. But it was pretty damn good. And guess what? We can follow these fish around the ocean. And guess what? We spent an insane. I mean, I can't even remember. I'll look at the invoice. $700-$900 per tag for a host of fish because they were external telemetry tags and they count the tail beats. So don't tell me it was caught by a shark. Because I can count the tail beats. And there's a difference between tail beats from an albacore, false albacore, and a shark. So shut up. You know, everyone has to be so goddamn smart and think they know something and be like, oh, well, what about this? Everyone knows this. And you're like, actually, no, not everyone knows that. This is what the science says, you know?
Well, it's really a tough position to be in because you talked about what goes into the science and research and how many people commit their lives to this stuff and how much time and energy goes into one individual study and then redoing or building upon an older study and all the cost share across different groups who put up. And then the other side of the aisle on these particular topics can just say, no, wrong. No factual basis, no scientific basis, and no stake in the game has not tried to prove or document otherwise. It's just, no, you're wrong, and I don't care how much. And so there is something to be said for defending not only a position or a brand's position, but defending just intellectual integrity when it comes to this stuff. We had a comment recently that's maybe made a point that's in contrary to what we said, but did so in a very respectful manner. It wasn't, you know, some of these other ones we've been kind of joking about. And our response was kind of, you know, okay, can you provide some peer reviewed science, or can you just show us some research that backs up your points? And that person, there's been a couple of those, and we are always open to those, right? Because that drives real, honest discussion, because maybe there is something that we have missed along the way. There's something worth considering. I don't think that there's this stance that we are the know-how or the know-all of everything that there is to do with fishery. So let's have these productive conversations and get smarter as a community. But the two times on this specifically that we said that, you know, like that's interesting. Where do you have, you know, resources that back up this claim? One of them just deleted their thread the next day. And the other we're waiting on a response and curious to what that's going to be. But we see some really cool stuff in the comment sections on different stuff on social too, where it'll be someone that I remember when they were first getting involved in some of these stuff. And now they'll jump in 2 years later and be like, actually, you're wrong. You know, remember when Virginia found this 2 years ago, and it's actually more like 10%. And you're like, you like see these advocates growing, and they're like, man, these people just, they really are listening. They eat up these resources and they're putting them to good use and trying to educate. And if they're willing to do that on a Facebook post, they're willing to do that in, like you said, in a shop or at the dock or at the pier or on a boat. And so momentum sparks more momentum, and education sparks more education. So
there's one other thing that people need to think about with this. Okay. And it's something that you can totally look up yourself. I mean, Christ, you know, with all the AI companions and stuff, like, it's worth just doing a little bit of research on this yourself. That's kind of the American way, in my view. But look at the consumption advisories for eating striped bass. Okay. And I need y'all to understand this. There is not a set methodology for the labs to do this testing. So let me explain. You know, all of the bad stuff, the heavy metals, mercury, PCBs, PFAS, it all accumulates in the fat. Well, a lot of this testing, they take the skin off, they take the brown meat off the striper fillet, and it's this perfect, pristine white fillet. And then here's the other thing. They usually test fish around 28 inches. They test smaller fish. Now, remember the otolith discussion from a couple of minutes ago? So 28-inch fish might be 7 years old. 50-inch fish might be 45 years old. 50-inch fish is eating probably larger prey. The larger prey has accumulated more mercury, PCBs, and PFAS in its system because it has been alive longer. So they're not doing any testing on these giant fish that commercial fishermen are catching and selling to restaurants. It's kind of dishonest. And then when they do the testing, they take the skin off. They take all the brown meat off. Is every person doing that when they cook a striper? Do they know that? And you look at the current consumption advisories with all these safeguards in place, removing all parts of the meat that actually contain the bad stuff. And they tell you one meal per month and young girls and women of childbearing years should not eat it. 8 ounces. You could theoretically keep one striped bass and that's what you should eat in a year. In a year. Okay. Well, what if you're eating one of those 50 pounders that the commercial guys are getting at a restaurant? The hell do you think is in that thing? And my position is just be honest about it so people can make the right choice and understand what they're eating. You know, I mean, this country has a long history of kind of lying about what you're ingesting. You bring cigarette companies up, you know, our product's not bad. Sugar's not bad for you. It's the fat. Processed foods aren't bad for you. Look at our food pyramid. Like, we have a pretty long history of lying to the general public about what you're putting in your system. And my position is just be honest about it so people can make the decision. And here's the kicker. DC did, I believe, the first consumption advisories that included PFAS. And they didn't take the skin off. Their consumption advisory is do not eat a striped bass. Ever. And there's pound nets in the Potomac River a couple miles south of DC that are catching these things commercially and selling them. How is that fish that's in the teeny tiny jurisdictional stretch of DC? How is that fish not the same fish that's in the pound net? They swim. I'm sure y'all know that. And guess what? When you look at the DNA studies from Mass DMF, that big population of giant fish that the commercial guys are catching off Massachusetts right now, they're predominantly Chesapeake Bay fish. So if you can't eat it at all in DC and it's a small fish, how's that work out? Questions we need to be asking. The fish are a lot older than we thought. Thanks for that research, Mass DMF. Finally put that to bed. And the larger females produce many more and individually larger eggs. And every time that you kill a fish that's 45 to 50 inches, I will most likely be dead by the, and so will anyone else that's 50. by the time that fish is replaced. So that's really something to think about. You know, that's you mush all that together. And I guess my reaction is to it is like, what the hell are we doing? We just don't get it. Just don't get it.
It's worth more consideration. It's worth more discussion going forward. I think, you know, we're presenting this as no call to action. There's no major movement point right now, but it's worth all of us getting on the same page as a community when it comes to the value of these fish, the bigger fish specifically, and the value of the spawning cycle and how we're on six and we might be looking in the face of seven. We'll find out here soon of poor spawns in a row. 7 years, 6 years minimum, and something's got to give, right? So we there's no longer any angles or any shortcuts to take. We need to keep an eye on the core of what makes more fish, because right now we are not gaining any stripers and we are only taking out stripers. And so until we can find a way to give this fishery a break where more stripers go into the barrel then come out, we are not making any progress. So a very worthy discussion. For those of y'all who haven't seen the stuff yet that we're talking about, hop on social, go check us some of it out, share it, pass it around, learn it, live it. And we're going to have a bunch more for you here soon. Good to get back on the podcast again. Spark a little bit of conversation, and we got a couple really cool guests lined up in the next couple weeks that'll keep this thing rolling. Happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July. Do not come to my house for burnt ends.
Happy 4th of July to all those who fight to defend America's beautiful natural resources, and watch your fingers around those fireworks. I'm talking to you, Jason Pierre-Paul.